Hi, everybody. This is Joanne with Read Science, and along with my co-host, Jeff Schomeyer. And we today are speaking with Caitlin Doty, who is an author and mortician. Mortician first, maybe. I don't know. We can talk about what you think you are first, because you're a great writer. She has written two books, bestsellers, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory. And her newest book is From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death. And Caitlin, why don't you say hi?
Hi, hello, good morning. It's very early for me, so I'm gonna try and focus and keep it together and talk death like an actual intelligent with it person this morning.
Well, you'll do better than I will at any other time of day, so I think this is okay. Hold on, I wanna find where I put your bio. Caitlin Doty is, as I said, a mortician, an author, a blogger, and a YouTube personality, and I've watched some of her YouTube videos and they're well worth it. Known for advocating death acceptance and the reform of Western funeral industry practices. She is the creator of the web series Ask a Mortician and founder of the Order of the Good Death. She's the author of the two books that I just showed you, and we are really happy to have you here. And you know, if we can talk science, we can talk science, but otherwise your information about death, I think, is very important. So, and Jeff, you can take it away.
Include this. We would include anthropology, I think, in our scientific purview. That's true. There is an awful lot to learn. I learned an awful lot from your wonderful book, Caitlin. Thanks so very much. When I was typing my notes last night, I found two that when I put them next to each other, seemed sort of to point me towards something that struck me as one of the important themes, one of the things you were really trying to get across to the reader, to the book. And so I want to say those. One, when I was early on in the book, I made a note for myself that American funerary habits seem purposely to be hands-off and sanitary. And I wondered why in the world that was and how it had come about. And then a little bit later on, still early in the book, when you were talking about the group in Colorado who does funeral pyre services for people, and you were describing people's reactions to it, I found it very moving when you said, what remains consistent is that the pyre experience for those present is transformative. And so I wanted to start maybe with, what are we missing? What do you think we could get from showing up for death? What are we missing by having such a hands-off sanitary culture in America these days?
Well, I'll try to not talk for the next hour that we have about that, because that really is an hour-long lecture.
Yes, that's the big topic, right?
Exactly, yeah, and that's kind of the whole thesis of my work and what it is that I do. And it's about why we have this weird, strained relationship, specifically in the United States, how that happened, why that happened. And I mean, you could say that it starts in the Civil War with embalming. Embalming, mortuary schools in America like to say that embalming is this ancient Egyptian tradition that we carry on through the ages. That's a little, you know, not quite true. The reality is that it was this specific type of embalming that we use in the modern American funeral home came about in the Civil War. Mm-hmm. The bodies from, or the soldiers, I should say, from the North were going to the South and fighting and dying on the battlefield. And it was really, really important at that time for families to see the dead body and be able to sit with it and say goodbye. So they ended up paying people on the battlefield who followed battle to battle with their embalming tents mm-hmm. to preserve the dead body through embalming and send them back up on the train. And that actually makes a lot of sense. If you're going to travel a really far distance and you want the body not to begin to decompose, embalming is a great idea, especially at that time.
It was a very practical move at the time.
It was very practical, yeah. And what happened, unfortunately, is that it was turned in after the Civil War in the early 20th century, it was turned into a business and it was pushed as something that everybody has to do, that it's sanitary. Speaking of science, there was this prevailing theory at the time called miasma theory, which mm-hmm. is that anything floating off, anything that smelled or was gross like sewage or rubbish or an overcrowded graveyard was spreading disease. And that's how you got sick, was this floating, smelly deadness coming off anything rotting. And, you know, at a certain point, scientists were like, germ theory, excuse me, that's actually how it's happening. But it was so prevailing, the narrative was so prevailing at that time with miasma theory that that just became what people believe and what this new funeral industry exploited as a reason that they had to take your bodies and be in charge.
Americans now, like early at the first quarter or so, or up through the 30s of the 20th century, had a great taste for sanitary things and technology things. And I've read these other books. It's like, this was where white bread came from. We can't imagine it now, but it was a miracle because it was hands off. It was packaged. It was pre-sliced. It was sanitary and modern. This is, some people claim why Jell-O molded salads were such a thing. They were technology, they were clean, they were glittery, and things do. You know, is it just our perverse tastes that we took this and turned it into this unrecognizable thing because of sanitary?
Yeah, I need to read more about that because I love the analogy that the American funeral industry is the white bread of, you know, of funeral industries, because I think it's absolutely true. There is this obsession with, we'll take the body, like, because death is, even though it's absolutely beautiful and meaningful and, you know, beautiful in its strange way, it can be hard and it can be messy and it can be intense. So the narrative was, let us take your dead. Mm-hmm. We'll do some magic behind the scenes to sanitize them, to prepare them, and then we'll sell them back to you, essentially. Mm-hmm. We'll sell them back to you as a product.
You just mentioned, though, something that also is an important current in the book, is that then before the Civil War, people spent more time with the dead people. They were closer to their dead people. And that was a big change. And your view is that we lose a lot by not spending that time, right?
Yeah. And it's a really kind of a problem to have the story that the embalmed body and the big casket is the traditional funeral industry. I still use that term because people immediately know what that means.
Right.
They're like, oh, the whole, you know, suit and the casket and the makeup. They get it. But it's actually kind of a problem because it's not tradition at all. That's just not true. The tradition was mom dies at home, you prepare mom's body at home, you build a pine coffin for her and you bury her in the local graveyard. That's the actual tradition of America, and it's a 20th century kind of white bread convention to have this new sanitized death system.
We've sort of simplified it too, haven't we? You're making me think about this, that it's like, well, we need to grieve. Okay, so we'll have a funeral service and you've got 45 minutes to grieve and then you're done with it. But spending the time with the dead person is not just about grieving, is it? And that's sort of back to that transformative experience with the funeral pyre that you were talking about. When you described that, I could see that you were talking about so much more than just some sort of closure or, you know, let it all out now and then we're done with it. There's a process of goodbying and recognizing and being with, and it's a lot fuller than just what we're sold on now, isn't it?
It's so full, and it's your existential opportunity. It's your opportunity to reckon and grapple with your own mortality, with the death of the person in front of you who's actually died, with the death of everyone who has died and will die. It's this opportunity to get in there in the mud and feel these feelings. And one of the biggest disservices that I believe the current funeral industry does or does to the public is turn it into exactly what you said, your 45 minutes to walk by the corpse and it's in the casket and it's hard and it has makeup on and you tap its hand and you're like, hi, grandpa.
You say
tap,
goodbye.
Tap, tap. Yeah, exactly, it smells right. A little weird. You're not like really in the moment. You kind of have to meet all these old cousins you haven't seen in 20 years. And it's just not, people do not report American wakes, the 45-minute American wake, as a transformative experience. No, I mean, if you've ever had a transformative experience at that kind of wake, you know, send me an email because I have not heard of your kind. I would like to come study you.
I thought about when I was reading your book, I thought about my parents, and of course my dad died sort of early from COPD, and you know, he was the kind, as you mentioned in your book, probably in both books, put me in a pine box, throw me in the ground, right? And you know, but instead, because the rest of the family expected the nice casket and everything, so my mother had to buy a nice casket, and I imagine when my mom dies too, this is what's going to happen, because this is all they know, right? And it just would seem weird to be cremated, or, you know what I mean? I don't know if this is tradition that's making people just continue to do that, or pressure, or religion. You know, this is where I was like, why will my mom do that? Oh, it's just, that's what we will do.
That's what we do.
Yeah, it's not one of the reasons that I feel so confident about advocating for change in the American funeral industry is that its roots are not religious. It's not. It would be much more uncomfortable for me if I was like, your religion's doing it wrong, or your old practices and your religion are wrong, because that's a whole nother kettle of, you know, toes being stepped on there. But it's not. I mean, you could argue that there's a religious connection in that if you want to have a big mass in the church, you know, generally they want you to be embalmed even though it's not required. Right. They want to have more control over the situation, but it's not religious in its roots. And so that makes it easier to have the conversation, I think, because you're not coming at anyone in that sense. But it is just, I think it is the early 20th century. I think World War I was also a huge influence because so many people died. Mm-hmm. And Americans kind of had this sick of death mentality to them. They didn't want to deal with it anymore. And then comes World War II, where we win and there's this huge economic boom. And I actually compare that to Japan because we're both these big, you know, industrialized nations. And I'm looking at the death customs and I'm saying, okay, what really is different about these two countries around the 1950s? It's like, oh, well, one country won World War II and one lost. And I actually think Japan's death customs are much more admirable than ours at this current time, because they didn't have the keeping up with the Joneses excess of the 1950s that got into the funeral industry and just stayed there, even when all these other things changed in the rest of the world and in the rest of America. Death customs at its core stayed this 1950s model of sanitation and excess.
And it's a negative feedback thing where we sanitize the funerals, so we distance ourselves from death, so we don't like to think about it. So as you've quoted people, you know, it's like, oh, this whole death thing just makes me squeamish. People avoid talking about it, which leads to making, when somebody dies, oh my God, you have to do something, and it happens very quickly, and there's the industry that pulls us in, as you show us, and we just keep ending up with the same thing, not to mention the constraint from municipal laws and things that tell us, no, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can do this or this.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I'm sorry, there was no real question there.
just a separate analysis. I want to ask, before we move away from embalming and talk about other things that happen across the world, during graduate school, I ended up taking most of my classes with medical students, and so I had the honor of doing a full body dissection, people who have donated their body. And at that time, they were still embalming with phenol and formaldehyde. But over the years, it's changed what they had to do trial and error to see what has worked, what is the best embalming fluid, what is the best preservative. And I was just wondering if you could speak to that, because I know you mentioned a little bit in your book about, you know, the from the Civil War time on forward.
Yeah, I mean, during the Civil War, embalming, honestly, it was like rip out the organs and stuff the chest with sawdust, you know, was one of the main techniques that they used, and carbolic acid and things that now we'd be like, oh, let's, no, that's not good. arsenic, you know, just like things that are not good and terrible. And, you know, formaldehyde and formalin are also not great. They cause blood cancers in the embalmers. This is a proven issue. It's a known carcinogen.
Right.
And, you know, it's ironic that embalmers whose career is to drain the blood out of a dead body and replace it with this formaldehyde and this formalin are dying from blood diseases. You know, that's kind of an irony that the old school embalmers will just be like, you know, they'll kind of gloss over it and they'll say that it's not a big deal and that they choose to do it, which is fine if you know the facts and you choose to do it. That's your choice, but it doesn't necessarily make sense to me why, if this is not a thing that's required and there's no real reason to do it, why are we hurting our employees and why are we hurting the environment and why are we doing this to, I mean, the dead body is dead. It doesn't care that it's a cancer-causing chemical, but why are we putting it in our dead bodies? Why are we, because I think there's a mental, how intense embalming is. It's a process where you, as I said, you drain the blood, you replace it with chemicals, you suck out all the fluid from the chest cavity and stomach cavity and replace that with chemicals. It's a pretty intense, visceral process. And I think there is some sort of subconscious mental problems that come with treating our dead that way, even if we're not exactly sure what's happening behind closed doors. Whereas something like decomposition, natural decomposition, which we find so threatening, is just the biological order of the world. That's what our bodies are supposed to do. So when I want people to embrace decomposition, it's because it's something that, you know, natural shouldn't be thrown around as much as it is, but it is what the body is designed to do at death. It's not designed to be human, you know, it's not designed to have that kind of human intervention at that intense a level with chemicals. You know, so I think that there's something that we subconsciously are taking on there that makes death more difficult for us because of that, this is where my morning brain comes in, but that, you know, that lack of being able to reconcile that violence around death.
Is embalming then right now in the US just a habit?
You know, that would be my argument. You know, there are still people, the African-American community, for instance, or some places in the African-American community that really, really value the embalmed body and the big wake and the whole shebang. And there are certain communities, certain very religious communities that really value it. And that's great. Embalming is a service that's going to be available to you, you know, for however long. But I think that for a lot of people, it is either a habit or something that they go into a funeral home and they're made to feel as necessary. Okay. Just as a, you know, starting off, no argument. Okay. And then we're going to be embalming Mrs. Smith. Okay. That's that charge. You know, it's not even a conversation that the family gets to have.
Whatever the profit margin is, there's no incentive for the funeral home to avoid embalming, is there?
In fact, it's necessary. The way that the American, and this is a whole nother conversation, but the way that the American funeral industry is regulated, and many of my close colleagues argue that it's highly overregulated. It's the model is you gotta do the embalming, you gotta do the casket, you gotta do the suit, you gotta do the flowers, you gotta do the hearse, you gotta do the whole thing. Otherwise, your overhead can't sustain itself and you lose the funeral home. So if someone's coming in and saying, you know what, I just want to have dad in a pine box, or I just want a simple cremation and to scatter his ashes at the pond near where we grew up,
that's threatening
to anyone who's in who owns a small funeral home.
Well, Jewish religion and Islam, they bury pretty quickly, you know. They don't embalm. So are there, you know, I mean, do the morticians go, well, I'm not going to earn as much money off this one?
Sure. That's how they feel. And sometimes when I talk about a natural or a green burial, which is just the body going straight into the earth, people will say, but isn't that what Jews and Muslims already do? And the answer is yes. And it's what we did 100 years ago, 150 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's our shared burial history cross-culturally is dig a hole in the ground and put the body in. You know, that is burial at its most simple. And most people just don't know that the American burial currently for the 20th century and 21st century is this hole very, very deep in the ground, unnecessarily deep in the ground, with this heavy casket and the embalmed body inside and a big concrete vault around mm-hmm. it. Most people don't, and if you don't have that knowledge, you're like, why are you pushing for this green burial? Why do you need to make it airy-fairy? Why do you need to, mm-hmm. you know, do this? It's like, well, because in a regular burial, your body isn't coming anywhere near the ground or the earth mm-hmm. that it's buried in. And if that sounds great and safe to you, again, that's available to you. But many people just don't know.
Ah, this does make me think, because my father was a veteran, and he's mm-hmm. buried in a veteran cemetery. And I wonder if they have regulations about that. Because, of course, that is as manicured as you can get, equal headstones yeah. all the way across. And, of course, then my mother will be buried next to him. Mm-hmm. They do that for veterans and their wives. And so I'm guessing that, you know, thinking about, oh, how would she be buried? Oh, because it's probably what they require or would like. And as you said, this vault is to keep it so the lawns keeper can have an easier time of things, right?
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, veteran, there is rumblings of the veteran cemetery being more open to natural burials. We did a veteran's burial with a Jewish man, and there was some wiggle room with how he was buried, and we were proud of that, to be able to do that, because for veterans, it's, you know, very inexpensive, if not free, for a lot of yeah. these services. At the National Center, where in other places, burial plots can cost quite a lot of money. So it's this really good service that the U.S. government is offering our veterans. But if you don't let them be buried as, you know, actually as meaningful to them or make sense to them, I think they're becoming more aware of that, though, at this current moment.
Interesting.
How did the whole preservation thing with the vaults and the embalming and all of that get so out of hand?
That's a good question. That's also like a 40-part question. We'll begin with the PowerPoint that I have prepared for you. But it's because of the starting in the Civil War, moving into the early 20th century, mm-hmm. there's also this sort of mini revolution within the revolution that takes place in Los Angeles at Forest Lawn, which is our big cemetery that has so many celebrities buried mm-hmm. there. And there was a man named Hubert Eaton, who they call the founder, and not like just like, oh, he's the founder. It's like the founder
yeah.
of the cemetery, Hubert. And he was the guy who really started to sell immortality, and he changed the American mm-hmm. funeral industry by bringing in euphemisms, the loved one, the slumber chamber. Mm-hmm. He named the different parts of the cemetery things like the eternal rest station, or, you know, the poet's walk and things like that. And he was the guy who really started the flat headstones, mm-hmm. the ones that are flush. So before that, right. the American cemetery was, you know, the headstone, the big headstone.
The memorial garden.
The memorial garden is a good example. Yes. And he started this whole, really pushed the American funeral industry to go in this flat direction. When you have flat headstones, you need to have these big vaults underneath the ground, as you said, to keep the ground from shifting and moving at all, and making it easier for the guy on the lawnmower to just buzz right over and snip the grass.
Wow. I do want to talk more specifically about your new book and your travels. And so before we talk about some of the travels, how did you, I don't know, what was the process of saying, I want to write a book like this? Who funded it? You know, how did this come about? Because I was like, wow, this is some production, you know.
How much fun is that? Yeah.
It's so much fun.
Yeah, well, it was funded by an underground consortium of international corpses who sent me around.
Please let everyone know we want this.
Yeah. No, it was not. It's funded by, you know, you have a publisher who likes your idea, so they give you an advance. to do it, and you have to use, I mean, I could have stayed home and just written whatever I wanted to write and saved that money, but like the point of getting the money was to be able to travel all around and see these things.
It's very effective that you went there, all these places.
Oh yeah. It wouldn't have been and originally, honestly, the book was going to be a little more around the world in 80 corpses, like more, it was supposed to be a transitional book that was a little lighter and a little easier. And that's not what it ended up being. I ended up writing a full other, you know, nonfiction book about this because I went to the places. And when you go to a place and you meet the people and you meet the dead bodies and you, you know, get into the culture, you can't just write a short description of it. You don't just want to write a, like, here's what they do in Indonesia. You know, it's not, it's, you get so into it and the stories and what's going on that you're like, no, this needs 9,000 words for it. And so that's sort of what happened. And as far as how I chose the places, it was places that were specialized access for me. I didn't want to go anywhere and just show up and see what other people would see. There are some other books about traveling to look at death customs. And it seems like either two categories. There's either the anthropologist who goes to a certain tribe or a certain area, and it's hyper-specific, and they stay there for 4 years, and then they write this thick book about it, which I love, by the way, and it's fantastic, and I really get into those. And then the other one is, like, I'm going to look at some things that happen around the world, and they're just like, and I went to Mexico, and they have altars for Day of the Dead, and I saw one family light these candles, and it's like, okay, that's interesting as an introduction, but that's not really getting into what, you know, any stories or, and there's no corpses in them. And like, why do you want a book with no corpses if you're me? Of course you want the real corpses.
You're saying then that you didn't really intend to get involved, emotionally involved with these people and these corpses, but you did.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, sure. That's what I tend to do. And so I went and it was facilitated by the fact, again, that these were places that I had some kind of special access. I either knew the people that were involved or ran them. I knew people who went for years and years and had studied these customs, or I was just some way in. So I was able to get in much deeper than I think I personally would have if I just showed up and was like, hey, I'm Caitlin. How are y'all doing?
I think that did the best service, though, to your advocacy and talking about what one gets out of showing up for death, because the emotional involvement was an important part of that. And I found some parts of it very moving. The point where you're talking about the funeral pyre, and there's a certain majesty that starts coming in when you talk about it being transformative. I felt that emotionally as well as intellectually. And one, I made a note. Oh, here it is. When you were talking about the experiment in composting, the Urban Death Project with Katrina at the body farm in North Carolina, right? And she's seeing the arrival of Frank, who is one of the people who has donated his body specifically for this purpose. So he is coming willingly to help, you know, further her project on this. And I don't remember if you asked her, if she said, but I felt really moved when she says, I'm filled with gratitude. It just said so much, and it's like, you know, we're too far. That really underlined your theme for me. I think those points worked really well for you.
Well, that's what's so important about bringing it back to science. I think that's what's so important about keeping the death local in a way. Yeah. So what I mean by that is, there's been a couple of exposés, honestly, recently about donating your body to science and the problems that come with it. And what I tell people all the time is, I wish that part of my main advocacy was donate your body to science. It's much less expensive and like, science, yay, progress. Like, I wish that was an easy answer for me to give people. But unfortunately, there's not a lot of, especially in the US actually, strangely, given our other death laws, there's not a lot of regulations around what private companies are allowed to do with scientific donations bodies. They can really chop you up and sell you for parts, which is macabre if you're not prepared for that. So if you're the type of person who's like, by all means, chop me, you know, use my face for plastic surgery, use my knee for orthotics, use my, you know, whatever, use my, you know, arm for bomb testing, like off I go to help. If you're in that mindset, great, you know, this is the thing for you. But if you're not in that mindset, if you think that you're going for this noble purpose and it turns out there's all of these, you know, issues with selling and buying bodies and this market for it, then it gets complicated and for the grief of the family as well. But what I loved about that body farm or that human decomposition facility in North Carolina is the fact that she was doing these experiments on this body that had been donated to study decomposition. And they told the family, they said, you know, is it okay if we use him? He already agreed to donate to this program, but is it okay if we use him to study human composting? Mm-hmm. And the family was like, yeah, he probably would have liked that. Yeah. You know, talk about like he wanted to be useful and he wanted to. And the fact that the woman who's actually doing these experiments or wants this to be the future of death care and what we do with our dead bodies is there and sitting with the donor body and saying, I am so grateful that you're here and that you're doing this. It felt, even though it wasn't, you know, exactly what I advocate, you know, which is sitting with the dead body and then having a more natural burial, it was very close to it because it was still being with the dead one-on-one, having this emotional moment, having gratitude for the life they lived and what their body is now doing for the people around us, and then doing something kind of useful with your body after you die. And it was kind of the perfect intersection of all of these things and what I wish scientific donation really, really was, honestly, and how it worked.
Right. Well, and like I said, it was an honor to dissect this person, you know, to further my education. And I was thinking about the embalming. I was, even though it was phenol and formaldehyde and got up under my contacts and made my hair gross and stuff, I thought, you know, honestly, I would not want a naturally decomposing body that I needed to work on for months.
No, of course. You know, and like, there's always places that embalming is useful. Mm-hmm. In that scenario is one. You know, I want to send my dad for a funeral in Germany. That's 2 weeks away and we want to be able to open the coffin and there he is.
Yes.
You know, that makes sense. Yeah, use it. Yeah. You know, exactly. If I wanted to be paraded around the town for a week and had various
Princess Di, right? We need
if you're Princess Di, if you're a president, if you're, you know, if there's some reason that you need to look, you know, to be moved around a lot. And to not be refrigerated and to stay looking kind of like you looked for a week or two, choose embalming by all means. It makes sense in that scenario.
And Jeff, I don't know if you caught, so the composting areas in North Carolina, you talked about cadaver dogs. And
the cadaver dogs.
And we had a woman who wrote a book about her experiences with cadaver dogs on our show a few years ago, and I couldn't help but think of it. And of course, Mary Roach wrote, Stiff,
that was
her first
Kat
book.
Kat Warren's book on her dog, who was a trained cadaver dog. And since you mentioned it, we've had a nice discussion about what happens to parts of bodies with Mary Roach, who wrote a book about the way bodies end up helping science. And some people would be shocked at some of the things that are done to them. But it also is kind of exciting because they're on the front lines of research, and you really do learn things from blowing up the bodies from below and trying to armor your cars against improvised explosives from the bottom.
And I certainly don't want to discourage anyone from donating to science. Yeah. I would just say, do your research, figure out something heartbreaking that happens to families too, is that they are so excited to donate their dad to science and dad signs up and then they're like, actually, we don't want your dad. You have to figure out something else. And all of a sudden they're scrambling to figure it out. So if you're going to donate to science, do your research. If you're the dead person or the dying person, figure out or reconcile those things. Be like, if I'm blown up for research, that's cool. I'm, you know, have that kind of Zen mindset about it. Because, you know, there's a way, I think what I've learned really from the years of doing this is that every kind of thing that can be done with a dead body, you can either look at it as, wow, what an incredible, meaningful ritual and thing that the body is doing, or you can look at it as what a barbaric, horrifying thing to be done to a dead body. And it's completely arbitrary depending on your culture, depending on your viewpoint, depending on your scientific bent, you know, whatever it is, whatever the lens you're looking at it, it can either be horrifying or it can be totally normal and make a ton of sense. And
this
it really is your journey to it.
The thought that caused you to mention the belief that most people have in the superiority of their own cultural habits.
Right.
And you also mentioned with regard to composting, and even with the science, is this lack of control. Once you're dead, and decomposition is really this ultimate lack of control over your body anymore, and, you know, or family members may see that. I thought that was interesting to bring that up, these feelings of letting go of your own body.
I think there's something to be said there too about control. You know, I don't know that it's a coincidence that when women took care of the body, which was, you know, prior to the Civil War, prior to the 20th century, they took care of the body in home, and the body hung out at the house, and then it went directly to decompose in the ground, and there was no intervention in that way. And then when professionalized men took over death in the 20th century, it became, we're going to sanitize you and clean you and preserve you and seal you up in multiple layers of protection. And then it's no coincidence that now it's really, for the most part, women who are leading the movement back to just letting the body decompose. And there are lots of theories for this. It might be because women give birth, and we give birth to death. We give birth to things that are going to die. We bleed every month. We have our bodies scrutinized so much during our life, whether it's our reproductive system, whether it's what we look like, whether it's whether we're aging. And at death, we kind of just have this, just let it go. Just let me get ugly and decompose into the earth, and you can't control me anymore. I don't know. There's a lot of things going on, but I think that the demographics break down pretty intensely along those lines, and that's worth looking into.
You can find any theory. I mean, we could be very Freudian and say, men, when it comes to bodily fluids, men eject them, and women don't. And so there's a whole viewpoint that would go with that and things, but it's just messed up sometimes. But speaking of, can we talk about Japan for a while?
Sure.
Because I was just so overwhelmed by the columbarium that you visited with all these little LED Buddhas that glowed in this lovely purple color, but could also be programmed for seasonal color schemes with things that flew.
Oh, yeah. There's a picture of the book.
Your wonderful illustrator.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank, it's a him, right?
Yeah.
Landis
Blair. Yeah, Landis Blair.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful. Yeah, added a lot to your book. I appreciate
it. Thank you. Yeah, I agree. It's this place. So you go in, and it's this old Buddhist temple. It's a Buddhist temple that you would expect an older Japanese movie, and the monk comes out and he's very wise looking and has his little glasses and his robes, and you're like, we are at a Buddhist temple, all the signifiers are there. But then you walk into this new columbarium they've designed to keep human remains, and you walk in and you have this tap card, just a regular kind of credit card sized thing that you would use on a subway, and you go to the keypad controller and you go boop boop boop. And it's connected to, if you're there, if you're a family member, it's connected to your mom. And all of these 360 degrees of little crystal Buddhas that correspond to your mom's ashes behind them light up. And then your mom's glows white to let you know how to find her Buddha and to be drawn to her. And you can also, it's also set up, there was a light designer that worked with them, and it's set up to do, as you said, a winter scene with, falling Buddha and moving, shooting stars where it goes from Buddha to Buddha, and the lights jump across. And you're standing in the middle of it, and you have this moment where you're like, is this tacky? Like, is this like gauche? But then you're like, no, like I love it. Like it really is. Like you get to this point where you're like, this is amazing. I'm having so much fun. I wish my mom was here. My mom's not dead. So I don't actually wish that she was, you know, dead and in this Japanese columbarium, but there's a sense of like, I would want to come to this place.
Yeah.
I would really want to come to this place, which is not, unless you're like a tapophile or someone who's really into graves or thing, most people are not like, oh, I can't wait to visit an American columbarium, because it's not cool. It's not fun. It's not engaged. It's just the same wall of, you know, granite or marble walls and the ashes behind names. And it's just,
it's very solemn.
Yeah, it's very solemn, and it's not that beautiful, and it's not—it's just not fun the way this was. And
so was that?
It makes so much sense.
Was that a transformative experience, going from is this tacky or what? And where's Hello Kitty? To you know, why shouldn't it be fun? This is lovely. This is a fun place to be. This is, why not?
Yeah, it was definitely a transformative experience, and I'm someone who has long been an advocate for being a Luddite around death, putting away your smartphone, putting away any technology, and just being with the body and being present. And I still, in many ways, stand by that after the actual death, in the hours or days following the actual death. But we live in a technological world, and this is our future, whether we like it or not. And so having just this, you know, especially in a big, big crowded city, it's not always possible to have, you know, to put you out in nature to decompose naturally. A lot of people are going to be cremated. That's just the way that it is. In Japan, it's 99.9% of people are cremated. They have the highest cremation rate in the whole world. And so if you're in Japan, you're going to be cremated. And what do you do with those ashes? It's important in their culture to come and offer incense and to offer prayers. It's really important to do that. And all these graves are so far outside the city because that's where land is. So people are feeling guilty. They're feeling like they're not getting there as often as they can. They feel this disconnect. And then all of a sudden you have these light up Buddhas right in the middle of Tokyo. And what a nice idea. What a great way to get in there. What a like fun place to visit. What a good place to, and it's fun without being like, and we set up a, you know, a carnival game or something, you know, or it's fun without being too pandering. And it's this cool monk who came up with all this himself for his own temple.
But it's not sanitized and all hidden away either. It is one way to keep in touch.
I think the other thing I liked to hear about was the one in Spain, in Barcelona. I thought, wow, that sounds really fancy and, you know, glamorous in a way, with glass and
it was
and beauty sort of scene.
I think that Japan and Spain are actually very similar in that sense, in that they're trying to figure out how to get people to show up and be happy in a modern way, or engaged in a more modern way, which is something that the US funeral industry is like very far behind on, and sort of bafflingly, I mean, you can trace exactly why that is, but we really, you know, guys, we're behind on this. And the way that it is in Barcelona is you go into this facility, it's 3 stories tall and has this glass atrium just looking out over the Mediterranean, Barcelona, and the palm trees, and it's in the ocean, and it's just gorgeous. And then you have families come in and stay the whole day with their dead bodies, but the bodies are behind glass in the Spanish style, as they call it. It's one big pane of glass, like a shop window. And then in the Catalan style is almost like a glass, like Sleeping Beauty coffin that the you know, casket slides into, and the body's in there, and they're temperature controlled inside the glass, and you can sit with them all day. And at first I was like, it's kind of the same thing, like, is this tacky? You know, it's kind of that same feeling, like, is it, I don't know about, why wouldn't you just sit with your dead body? Why are you keeping them behind glass? Like, that seems wrong. But a ton of people show up, way more people than show up for US things. And then at their crematory at the cemetery, they also had a big pane of glass separating you from this very beautiful marble floored crematory machine. And you know, would have to stand behind the glass when the body is loaded into the cremation machine. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm going like, oh, why can't you just stand by the cremation machine? But everybody shows up for these cremations. I can't get anyone to show up at at my funeral home, it's a little easier because people do, we want people to do it.
Yeah, and that's part of what
we promote. They seek me out specifically for that. Yeah. But, you know, it's kind of the same. It's the same transition. It's the same transitional moment of being like, okay, like that's not exactly how I saw the best way to do it. Mm-hmm. But they, for their culture, have figured out how to get people enthusiastic and involved and be present. And isn't that the goal?
It seemed like another transformation for you as you were writing it, because your first reaction, right, was they're still separated. It's a bit sanitary, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But by the end of it, you got to but they showed up. They were present for death.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of became the motto. And that's the thing, right, of not hiding it away somehow, but of finding a way to be with it.
Yeah, finding a way to be with it. And what, you know, and that makes me think about what would work for America, because mm-hmm. I'm, you know, as I said, I tend to be a bit of a purist, and I tend to be like, just hang out with your dead body. That's what mm-hmm. you have to do. That's our salvation, is hang out with your corpses. And, you know, it's purposely not incendiary, but it's purposely the furthest demonstration of what is possible. But a lot of people are like, I am not prepared to hang out with my dead body. That is a lot for me. I do not feel like I can emotionally take that on. I understand you said that everybody did that 100, 150 years mm-hmm. ago. I hear that, but I'm not ready. So you have to say like, mm-hmm. okay, what about just an hour? Or what about just 10 minutes and just mm-hmm. calm down and be with the body? But, you know, it gets me thinking, what actually is the thing that would get people mm-hmm. excited about being present for death and being with the dead? It's not the current American funeral industry. Mm-mm. Nobody's excited to go to a funeral or excited to go to a cemetery for the most part for their own loved one or their own dead loved one, because there's just not that connection. There's not that genuine mm-hmm. getting butts in the seats, interactive, engaged experience that these other places have. Yeah.
Well, and I have to say, so your books were eye-opening, one about the practices, but also like, well, I would probably show up for some of these different unique things, mm-hmm. you know, because I've been to plenty of funerals and, you know, they are exactly as you described, this sort of weird, awkward, you're as stiff as the body in the casket. I just felt like you really enlightened me as to what can be done.
Okay. Well,
and I mean, I've always sort of said to my kids that cremation sounds like a good way to go, because I always thought I always thought it seemed weird to preserve a body that's supposed mm-hmm. to decompose. It just goes against the biologist in me. So
yeah. Well, you know, my favorite stories that I get from people are, I stood up for my rights and demanded this specific thing that I wanted. Mm-hmm. And you know, for everyone, it's not the whole shebang. It's not, and I sat with my mom for a day and then I snipped little locks of her hair and then I took her myself to the crematory and I pushed the box in and set it alight and then I took her bones out individually. You know, it's not, for most people, it's not mm-hmm. the full interactive program, but there's probably gonna be something in there that's really meaningful to you. And you know, I was just gonna say, for your kids, for example, it might be that your hair is really iconic to them and they want just like a couple locks of your hair to put in some jewelry or put in a thing. And if they go to the funeral home and the funeral home goes, oh, we don't really do that, you know, they have to stand up and say like, what are you talking about? That's our mom, that's our hair, give us the damn hair, you know. And when you know your rights in that way, you'll be able to articulate them. By the way, if your funeral home is saying you can't have any hair, like, don't use that funeral home. That's not a good thing.
Well, your books sort of blend together to me, but there were some places where people would say, you know, someone would come in and say, oh, no, we have to take the body now. And actually you would say, no, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
it depends, it differs state to state, but I thought that was interesting too, that we, you know, we are automatically told, no, this is what has to happen.
Well, in any state, it's not really true. In some states, you have to, you know, there are different amounts of time before you have to refrigerate the body. But refrigerate can just mean, if you're a family, refrigerate can just mean put on some ice packs. Mm-hmm. Or honestly, like, turn down the air conditioner. There's no corpse police. There's no one coming after you. If mom dies and it's not an emergency, it's not like she, you know, died by suicide or fell and hit her head, but it's just a natural, you know, death at home that was expected. It's not an emergency. It's absolutely 100% not an emergency. Just figure out what you want to do. You know, you're sitting there with mom. Do you want to keep sitting with her? Okay, do that. Do you want to get her out because you're feeling not great about it? Okay, fine, do that. But really take stock of how you're feeling and make a decision based on that, not based on the cultural expectation that it's an emergency. You got to move, move, move.
This is another reason it's useful for people to read your book.
Yeah.
For all the things they can learn, but also for the things that it normalizes. And I think maybe when someone dies, people so much want to do the right thing, and they feel like there must be, like, you know, I read in a Martha Stewart magazine once, it's like, what's the proper way to fold a fitted sheet? And I thought, you know, you just want a good result. There's not a proper way, but I think people want to do the right things, the proper things when someone dies, right? But they don't know what to do because we hide it all away. And it's
well, they want to do, yeah, they want to do the proper
things. It's nice to know that you can ask for things and that you can insist on things and you can do it your way.
Absolutely. They want to do the proper thing, and they also want to do the legal thing. Mm-hmm. But they have way more legal rights than you assume. If you have a question about what you can do, that there are some things that are hard. For example, most states don't allow you to bury a body on your own property. Mm-hmm. That's a harder thing. Some places do. So look it up. Look, Google your state and home burial and see what happens. But other than that, in the couple of days after someone dies, the family has complete control for the most part over that dead body. It's yours. You, if you're the next of kin, do what you want. You know, do whatever kind of ceremony you want. Maybe take it to a funeral home. Maybe, but even when it goes to the funeral home, they have custody of that body, but they don't have control over that body. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, they still have to do. They're a private company that is contracted to do what you personally want them to do.
Right.
For
right.
your
you're
death.
Paying that kind of money. Yeah, they should.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. They should do what you want, and they don't, you know, there are some situations where they say, oh, no, well, you can't do this, or we, you know, it's like, no, okay, is that the law, or do you just not want to do that? And you have to tell the family that. If it's something that you personally are not willing to do as a funeral home, that's your right as a business, but you can't tell the family that it's the law or it's the regulation that's happening. You have to say, it's me who can't do this.
And yet, if you want to start a company that helps people have open air funeral pyres, you're going to have some negotiation before you get to it.
You sure are. And that's, you know, to bring it back to your original question, that's why this town in Colorado called Crestone is so amazing, because they've really stepped outside the funeral industrial, as I call it, and really are taking on death themselves and have their own open-air pyre to cremate the bodies.
Right.
And it was incredibly difficult. It was incredibly difficult to get to that point. And they started, even when they started in Colorado, which has the most lax death laws in the country.
Mm-hmm. When we, I'm sorry.
I'll let you finish, Jeff, and then I'll ask her.
No, I was just gonna say, I realize we're starting to get close to the end. So, you know, I'm getting to my leftover, not exactly questions, but I did write down two things that struck out, two little quotations. One was, let me see if I can find it. I wrote down under the heading, sentences I never expected to read, quoting, she's much more than just a lover of livestock composting. I never thought I would hear that combination of words.
Yeah, I try to do that. I hope that a lot of my sentences in books are things that people are like, huh, those are words in a combination that I wasn't necessarily expecting. Yeah, that's the goal.
And the other one out of context is just so superb, was No watermelons.
No watermelons. Yeah, you can't put watermelons in the cremation machine in this crematory in Japan, in Tokyo.
Yeah.
No watermelons.
It says so
explicitly. No watermelons. I mean, there's a list of other things, but most importantly,
and the list of, you know, one of these is not like the others. The watermelon sort of stood out. So, you know,
wonder
what's the story with watermelons.
It's such a specific fruit,
yeah,
too. It's not like no fruit. Like, fruit is okay, but watermelons, like,
well,
it's just too large, unnaturally large fruit.
In Japan, and people say, we've got to put a watermelon in Uncle
Joe's. I know, exactly. Was there this rush of watermelons that they're like, we got to put this on the list, guys. We thought we could get away with leaving it off the list.
No,
but there are just
on.
So many cremated watermelons, and it's causing a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something that I know. That one, it was sort of I never really got to the bottom of that. It wasn't like something that I investigated, but I probably should, because it's probably an interesting answer.
Yeah,
you can write a whole book called No Watermelons.
Yeah, No Watermelons, Cremation Culture in Japan.
So we're near the end, and I want to ask you two things. Do you've got another book in mind?
I do. We haven't announced it yet,
sure.
But... I think it's going to be cool. I think it's going to be really cool. I think it's going to be fun. And I think that, I don't know. It's not like, you know, I'm not under some like huge contract. It's not like, I don't know what I'm allowed to say, but I think that
I
we're
understand.
Still working on how to announce it. But yeah.
I'm happy to know. I will be on the lookout for something new.
What's interesting is that after my first book, it was like, I don't want to do another book. I don't know if I'm going to do another book. Uh-huh. And now I'm pretty excited about it. I've integrated it into my life enough that I'm like, yes,
good.
We're doing another book.
Good.
Books.
Great. Well, and you're a great writer and you have great insights. So I'm really grateful
you
continue to write.
Thank you.
The last thing I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the fact that you are the founder of the Order of the Good Death. And what is that?
Sure.
And should people in our viewing audience be joining or...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So the Order of the Good Death that's kind of the oldest part of my advocacy. It started in 2011, and it's academics, it's writers, it's people who are in the funeral industry or in the death industry in general, artists, people who make death their life's work and want to share death with the world, make people more comfortable with it, make people more engaged with death and dying. And we have our sort of founding members that are on our website, orderofthegooddeath.com. But anybody can join the order. It's kind of like like the ACLU. You can just say, I identify as a member of the order. And there's even a place to sign up on the website if you agree with what we do and what we stand for. And yeah, we'd love to have you.
That's great.
Cool.
That's great. And also, I want to just take a moment here to once again plug your podcast/YouTube series, mm-hmm. Ask a Mortician, right?
Definitely. Yeah, Ask a Mortician on YouTube. Yeah.
So any question you've probably had about death, probably you've made enough videos by now. You're answering most of them, right?
That's true. And so it's like me here, except I'm more like, hi.
Yes.
With you, Jen.
Hi,
everyone.
Intrigued by one where you had, I don't know, it was a word, and then these two cats with wings floating up. I'm like, wow, okay, this is different, and you know, but fun. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we sign off?
No, this was great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm sorry that it was so early in the morning for me, but hopefully we'll look back on the YouTube link and see if I was coherent or not.
You definitely were.
Any words or anything. It was great.
Yeah. Well,
so, thanks for having me.
We are so glad you came, everybody. If watching videos is not your thing, well, then you're probably not here. But go ahead and check out her book, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, which is sort of like how you got into all of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's
great. It's a memoir about my first time at a crematory. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then her newest book, From Here to Eternity. And we will keep our viewers and my followers on social media updated when her new book comes out. Caitlin, thank you so much. This was really great and informative, and we're glad you came.
Yeah, thank you both. Bye, everyone.
Bye.